for the week of March 17th, 2013, St. Patrick's Day. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 186, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And from County Clare, I'm Michael Gilt.
County Clare. Ooh, there's an Irish reference for you.
That's right. Thought I'd toss it in for St. Patrick's Day. I have the blood from the Scanlans in me, so there you go. Celebrating St. Patrick's Day. I forgot to wear green today, so I felt bad about that. But I did sing some Bing Crosby songs.
Well, I don't know. Blood from the Scanlans, that sounds like a disease.
No, for God's sakes, no. It's my family roots in Ireland, the Scanlans.
Oh, that's okay. Sorry, I didn't know that that's what you were referring to. So, Michael, I have to warn you, I'm a little depressed today.
Why?
Because last week, Google announced that they were inexplicably closing down Google Reader.
What's Google Reader?
And that would be why they're closing it down, I'm sure. Google Reader, it's an RSS reader. It's where I get all my news feeds.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I barely know what an RSS reader is. I've never used one. I'm sorry to hear that, I guess.
They said that usage had dropped and had slipped, so they were shutting it down. And based on your comments here, I would imagine that usage had dropped.
Well, I don't use any other RSS reader myself. It's just something to let you know stuff that would interest you. You say, oh, add in the Times, the LA Times, this website, that thing, and it's all one big feed to tell you what news stories are coming out.
Right, and they're all, you know, divvied up into different categories like arts and entertainment and tech. And
it was the wave of the future until it wasn't.
That's right.
So who's doing the RSS feeder now? Who will you turn to? Where will you go?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of people.
But there's no big dominant player?
Yes. And by the way, I know that you're probably a little upset because
I'm not Pope.
You're not the Pope. I know if you listened to last week's show, Michael was hoping that because he is a registered Catholic that, maybe.
I had a shot.
Outside chance, you might. But they came out and announced Abamus Papum. And I thought to myself, whoa, wait a second. That's the Latin word that's trending on Twitter right now. I do not understand why all of these people are talking about a 2 to 3 year old Nanni Moretti film.
Well, it's funny you should say that because, in fact, they're re-releasing this film in theaters on Friday, at least in New York. It's called We Have a Pope. Abamus Papum is what that means. And it's a charming film. I saw at Cannes 3 years ago, a nice little comedy about when they select a new pope and the guy freaks out and is like, I don't want to be pope.
And he runs
and
away.
He runs away and they have to bring in a therapist to talk to him. And so the therapist is trying to interview the pope. And there's like 800 cardinals surrounding him as he tries to do some personal therapy and help the guy work through his issues. It's a cute little movie. Very sweet. It's probably only in a few major cities, so I doubt most people have a chance to see it, but it's probably available on Netflix or DVD somewhere, so if you get a chance, check it out. But when people are checking out today's show, what will we be talking about?
Ooh, nice little segue there. Well, on today's show, we are going to be talking to one of the industry's best television reporters, Bill Carter of the New York Times. He's going to be joining us to discuss the topsy-turvy winter network ratings, as well as what's kind of going on over at late night television, at least here in the United States. I realize that many of our listeners are overseas and they don't get our late night, although many of them get The Daily Show. So we'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure. And we'll also talk about the Cannes Film Festival and how they broke the tradition that they've had for, what, umpteen years by selecting The Great Gatsby as its opening night film. Twitter is getting into the music streaming business just like everyone else in the world, it seems. We'll tell you all about it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll finish up with some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Last week, we didn't get to Jonathan Rogers' email, who took us to task, or is taking us to task, for making...
He helpfully corrected us.
Yes, I guess that's what I should say. Although, again, I say it isn't our fault exactly. It's totally our fault. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
As always, we give you the figures for the box office around the world. And the number one movie around the world this week is Oz, the Great and Powerful, for the second week in a row. It grossed $88 million worldwide. It's at $281 million and counting. Good Lord, this looks like another Alice in Wonderland, a very bad film that proves very popular.
And so there should be a sequel to it.
Well, there are. It was intended to launch a franchise, and they're succeeding. There are a lot of Oz books, and there's a lot of stuff you can draw upon, a lot of storylines, before you have to deal with Dorothy, which they do not have the rights to. They don't have the rights to The Wizard of Oz.
Hey, you know what I saw this week? Totally off topic and a complete aside that I'm sure you will kill me for later, is I saw End of the Rainbow, the musical about Judy Garland.
The End of the biopic about Judy Garland.
Well, it's not a biopic. It's a biodrama on stage.
Oh, that. Oh, that's what you. Oh, I thought you meant the TV movie Me and My Shadow. Oh, you mean End of the Rainbow, the show about Judy Garland. It's one of her last nights. She's in a hotel room preparing for one of her last comeback concerts before she died.
Correct.
That. What did you think of it?
I thought it was actually pretty good.
Who was the lead? Was it the woman who did it on Broadway?
Yes, it was. One of them. There were two.
And who is that?
Yeah, I wish you wouldn't ask me things like that.
You just saw the show and you don't know who the star was?
I can't remember. I thought, hey, she's pretty good. I'll never.
What do you mean there were two? There was just one woman. It was just one person who played it on Broadway.
I can't remember her name.
All right. But it was good. You liked it.
I did like it.
I didn't particularly care for it on Broadway, but, you know.
I don't know why they haven't made that into a movie.
Well, there have been Judy Garland TV movies. There have been lots, all sorts of things about Judy Garland.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so that's End of the Rainbow stars Tracy Bennett.
Yes, thank you.
But yeah, that's her. It's the only person who does it. It's nobody else.
Okay. My apologies, Tracy.
That's all right. Well, it's been a long time since Wizard of Oz was in the box office, but the prequel Oz, The Great and Powerful, did great. At number two around the world is A Good Day to Die Hard. That's the fourth or the fifth Die Hard movie?
The fifth?
I think it's the fifth. It grossed $21 million worldwide, most of that coming in China, where it had a really big weekend at the box office. It's now at $266 million worldwide. So this movie has made only $65 million in North America, and it's made $266 million worldwide. So it's definitely, you know, it's quadrupled its U.S. box office. So a movie that would have been a really iffy proposition based on its North American box office is proving to be a big hit around the world. I forget what the budget for that was, but that's probably a good amount for them. I think the budget was about $92 million. So that's a lot of money, but they're looking like they're going to triple it. So it's at least they won't be losing their shirt. And number three around the world is The Call, the unexpected movie that trumped the incredible Burt Wonderstone in North America. The Call is a thriller starring Halle Berry. It grossed $17 million. It opened basically in North America only. At number four around the world is Jack the Giant Slayer, another would-be franchise. This one not nearly as successful as Oz the Great and Powerful. It grossed $16 million. It's at $89 million and counting. At number five, a big disappointment. The Jim Carrey, Steve Carell comedy, The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, a film about rival magicians. It grossed $10 million in North America. Quite a disappointment. Handily trounced by the Halle Berry thriller. So that movie has opened poorly. It didn't cost a lot to make, about $35 million. But I'm sure also Carell and Jim Carrey had some sort of piece of the box office, since it was such a low price. Clearly, they were not paid up front a lot of money. So it'll be a lot harder for that one to reach profitability.
Well, and it didn't open to horrible reviews.
Oh, no, it was terrible. Got bad, horrible reviews and terrible audience. The audience hated it. The people who went to see the movie did not like it. It got a C+ at a cinema score. Cinema scores where you walk out of the movie and they say, hey, what'd you think of the film? Those are people who went to the movie on opening weekend. They're the most ardent fans. And if you get anything less than an A-, you're probably in trouble.
Is it every week I read the two reviews that are completely opposite what everybody else is thinking critically? You know, I read two good reviews of this film, which probably are, as I'm seeing here on Rotten Tomatoes, the only two good reviews received.
What reviews did you read?
Oh, I can't remember. You always ask me these. I think it was The Hollywood Reporter was one of them. And maybe the LA Times. Maybe the LA Times. Don't quote me.
It's 39% for all critics and 24% for top critics. It has horrible reviews from everybody.
Yeah, I can't
You'd be
remember.
Hard-pressed to find anybody who said something nice about it. The Denver Post and Time Magazine called it semi-bad, semi-inspired. That was the nicest thing anyone said about it.
Oh, it was in Variety.
It isn't incredible, says the Detroit News, but it's nicely performed.
It was Variety where I read it.
Variety gave it a good review?
Yes.
Wow. Here's a positive review. Fitfully amusing. Slightly overextended comedy. Those are the positive reviews that movie got. So you need to just, that's why Rotten Tomatoes is handy.
That's true.
Gives you a good, quick overview. No, got terrible reviews. The audience hated it. Going to collapse next weekend. It opened poorly. At number six is Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, another $6 million. It's at $205 million worldwide and counting. And then at $5 million, we have Identity Thief, the comedy starring Melissa McCarthy and Jason Bateman that made another $5 million. Right below that, at just over $4 million, we have about three movies. Warm Bodies, the zombie flick, that grossed $98 million and counting. Mama, the horror film starring Jessica Chastain, that is at $118 million worldwide. And Journey to the West. Yes, we finally have more information on the Chinese film that's breaking box office records in that country. After 4 weeks of not quite hearing what was going on, we got some more money, some more information on it. It has grossed another $4 million this weekend so far. It's grossed $197 million total in China. It's about $4 million away from setting the box office record for the all-time top grosser for a Chinese film in that country. It slowed down quite a bit, so it probably won't pass Avatar, but it will almost certainly, no, it will become the highest grossing Chinese film of all time in that country. So Journey to the West, we finally got a little more information. It's still in the top 10 in China and raking it in. What it did last week and the weekend before and the weekend before that, we don't know. But that movie, a big hit, presumably, we'll see it at some point in North America. And then rounding out the rest of the box office, we have a couple movies that are about $3 million, five or six or seven movies, most notably Les Mis, which is at $430 million, and Django Unchained, which is at $407 million.
I guess you don't want to talk about the French version of Seabiscuit, Japaloup.
Well, Japaloup opened in France. It grossed $3 million exactly. It seemed to be open in that one country only. It's released by Pathé, a major French distributor. It is sort of a French spin on Seabiscuit. It's not about Seabiscuit, but about a horse popular in France that had a, you know, marvelous tale of triumph at the racetrack. There's a couple of movies that we haven't read. There's a Korean film that was a big hit that we've just gotten information about called New World. That movie grossed $2.6 million this weekend, but it's made almost $28 million in South Korea.
I was going to say it hasn't made anything in North Korea.
Well, it may have made enemies in North Korea. So that movie is a big hit there. That's a lot of money for that one country. So that about rounds it out for the box office.
Really? I thought for sure you were going to mention My Paparazzi.
My Paparazzi. Tell us about it, Sperling.
Okay.
It sounds like an Italian film, but it's not.
It's not. And actually, that's why I thought you were going to mention it, because it's a South Korean film about a high school gangster who is taken under the wing. The teacher takes him under the wing and teaches him to sing like a Pavarotti, his hero. Something.
Whose
like
hero?
That.
The teacher or the student?
The students.
He's a gangster whose hero is Luciano Pavarotti.
That's right.
That is a movie.
An opera singing high school gangster. That's
it sounds like an episode of Glee.
It probably was stolen from.
I was a little confused this week on the box office because we found a new source of information. It's not perfect, but it's a lot easier than what we've been pulling before. It comes from RentTrack, which is a company that bizarrely started tracking apartment rentals around the country. It's a company based in Portland, but they segued somehow into box office reporting. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but they now get information from around the world, and they have a pretty useful chart that we discovered that does do a weekend worldwide box office. It's mostly, you know, geared towards industry and industry analysts and reporters and people like that. So it's a new chart that we have, but it doesn't have numbers next to it, you know, ranking 1 through 10. So it's a little tricky for me to follow where I am. And they don't have every bit of information. They did not have Journey to the West in their roundup, for example. So there are movies from certain countries that, unless they're being reported to, they're going to let them slip through the cracks.
Well, I can actually explain to you how RentTrack came to being, but that's
please do
another story entirely. Well, in the early 2000s, you had Nielsen EDI, which was collecting EDI had been collecting grosses throughout North America and the world for quite
that
some
was
time.
Exhibitor
Data Incorporated or something like that. The way they collected data was they had call centers, and they would call the box office at every single theater and write down what each film had made that weekend or that night. And then they would pass that information along to the studios. Well, they kind of had a monopoly on this. They had cornered the market, and so were charging the studios an arm and a leg for it. And eventually, what wound up happening was in the early 2000s, Chris Aronson, who now heads up 20th Century Fox's distribution, worldwide distribution, and Ron Giambra, who was working, I can't remember where, I want to say.
But they said, hey, some healthy competition would go well here.
Right, and Tribune, they were working at Tribune for a while because Tribune said, hey, we do this for television, we do ratings for television, let's do this as well. Box office didn't really work out there, so by 2002, they had moved to RentTrack, which was tracking apartments, and they had kind of gotten into DVD rentals and
They went from apartment rental to DVDs.
Yes, because that was something that could be tracked because there was point of sale systems that, you know, cash registers that were tracking everything. So it was very easy to track on a technology basis. It was easy to do. And Ron Giambra and Chris Aronson went out there and gathered up all the exhibitors in North America and launched and just decimated Nielsen EDI's business. And a couple years ago, RentTrack actually purchased Nielsen EDI. So now they're still.
But now if they're alone, how come they're not charging an arm and a leg?
Well, because they've learned, hey, you know, the studios are only willing to pay so much before they start looking for an alternative.
Well, there you go. So they tend to get, like a lot of other people, if the major studios report info to them from overseas, that's where they get information from. If they're not tied into a major distributor, then it's hard to, you know, track that. So that's why major distributors in France, like Pathé and other people, will provide info on their local films. But other movies, like Journey to the West, might slip through the cracks. Now, this
well, it's more the exhibitor that's the issue. It's more whether the movie theater is a top earner and has a...
Well, we know how important the Chinese box office is, right. But of course, they're not tied into the systems that we have in the West right now.
Yeah, they're really closed off. In fact, so closed off that did you know that IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, you couldn't access it in China for the past 3 years? I didn't know that.
Right. It's hard to get info out of China about some of their box office hits. It's also hard to get info into China because their internet is highly regulated. Of course, everybody knows that their internet is one of the most censored and regulated in the world. But I didn't know it extended to IMDb. Why the heck would that be?
Well, I think because there's a code in IMDb that allows spies to talk to one another. That's probably why.
What?
Okay, I was kidding. You were supposed to, you know.
Okay.
You were. Wow, you're a horrible straight man. What can I say?
I've been told that many times before.
You were actually believing me. Actually, they closed it down because they didn't really want their citizens to get information on some of these films, like When the Dragon Swallowed the Sun, which is a documentary about Beijing's annexation of Tibet in 1950. There was also a film that I wonder if you saw, Michael. It's Lu Yi's 2006 movie, Summer Palace. It premiered at Cannes, and if I'm not mistaken... You and I were staying in an apartment together, and I think you did see it then.
Yeah, it's a movie with the backdrop of the pro-democracy student movement in Beijing up until 1989 in Tiananmen Square. It was more of a soap opera, and I think it was just as controversial for having, I wouldn't call it an explicit sex scene, but for China, a relatively explicit, you know, there was a topless woman, I believe, in the scene. So that was a bit outré for them. But there's obviously hundreds of movies, thousands of movies about Tibet and the Dalai Lama and oppression in China. And all of which would be on IMDb, whether it's TV documentaries, feature films, episodes of TV shows, and all that stuff. They don't want their people to see it all. So they banned IMDb completely for a long time. I wonder what made them lift it.
I have no idea. I know that you can, not only did they lift this ban, but you can actually search for movies like Summer Palace, this movie that premiered in Cannes.
Right. They lifted the ban.
Right.
They didn't, they couldn't limit one or two movies. It was either an all or nothing proposition. They tried to force IMDb to, you know, eliminate certain films, but that didn't work out. IMDb said, take a hike.
That's right. Well, we're assuming. But we're talking about Cannes. While we're at it, I guess maybe we should mention this year at the Cannes Film Festival. I don't know which year it is. The 71st, 70, I don't know which year it is. But The Great Gatsby, Baz Luhrmann, is coming back to Cannes with one of his films. He was there in 2001. With Moulin Rouge, which opened the festival and started its worldwide tour this year.
Very successfully.
Very successfully. It went on. Was it nominated for Best Picture? I think it probably...
Might have been, yeah.
Might have been, yeah. This year, he's bringing The Great Gatsby, this film that we began reporting on back in 2009 when they were doing readings. And now it's going to open this year's Cannes Film Festival. But it's a little, I don't want to say controversial, it's breaking tradition.
Well, typically, the movie is supposed to be making a world premiere if it's at Cannes. It's not supposed to be a movie that's been seen elsewhere. Every once in a while, they let a movie debut in France, like the week before, something like that. So they've had little loopholes before, and this movie is very similar. It will open in North America 5 days before it opens in Cannes. So in this case, it will be the European premiere of the film. But that is somewhat unusual for them.
Well, especially for the opening night film. The opening night film was
well,
always...
Well, that's the film we're talking about, yeah.
Right. I mean, in the middle of the festival, they'll have some film that has premiered. Like they had Indiana Jones a couple years ago that had premiered like a day ahead of time.
Right, it's the same
US.
Idea.
Yeah, so it's... But I guess, do you think it's...
I think that was seen. No, the thing with Indiana Jones that critics saw it in North America and were able to review it, but I don't believe it had opened in North America.
No, it had not.
Right. Yeah, this will actually have opened in theaters. People can go see it in North America before it debuts at Cannes.
Right, but like movies like Mission to Mars had opened, and Kung Fu Panda and Shrek had opened when they were shown in Cannes.
So then, why are you saying this is a big deal?
Well, I think the opening night film was always a premiere. Those films were kind of add-ons that they were kind of, in a way, throwaway films that they invited out of competition to bring the stars. And the opening night film was always this big hoopla with, you know, first time anybody's seen the film and the stars would show up and they got a lot of press.
All the movies in competition are original and they're making their world debuts.
Right.
So that continues. The opening night film often was a French film for many years.
Right.
But it was hard for them to come up with a big enough film with enough stars that people would care. And so that was a perennial problem. So they dropped that. And, you know, as you've listed a number of movies in other areas that were not world premieres, you can see that it's not that unusual anymore. And they want Leonardo DiCaprio and Carey Mulligan and all the other stars of The Great Gatsby to be there walking the red carpet at Cannes. And they swallowed it and said, oh, well, they wished Warner Brothers had held the film a week and let it premiere at Cannes. But they're like, sorry, we're already locked into our release date.
Well, that's because Star Trek Into Darkness is opening up a week later on May 17th. And then Warner Brothers has its own film a week after that on May 24th, The Hangover 3. So there was no place to move this film. They had to, you know, they already moved it from December into summer. They couldn't move it again.
Right. Well, it's hardly competing with either of those.
Well, that's true.
It'll be lucky. It was nominated for 8 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actress. It won some technical awards. So Moulin Rouge was a successful hit. It made a lot of money. Great Gatsby, of course, is a lot more troubled. It's in 3D. We'll have to see how the Cannes critics react to that. There have been other films in 3D. But, you know, this is a movie that I imagine they're going to really regret making the opening night film, because chances are, I just have a bad feeling, it's going to get terrible reviews in North America and then open in Cannes and feel like a big so what.
I couldn't agree with you more. We'll have to wait and see how that plays out, Michael. But that kind of wraps up our movie news and moves us along into television, where we have a special guest. We're going to be speaking with Bill Carter from The New York Times. Mr. Carter has been covering television over at The Times for several decades now. He is also the author of the 1994 best-selling book, The Late Shift, Letterman, Leno, and the Network Battle for the Night. More recently, he wrote The War for Late Night, When Leno Went Early and Television Went Crazy. That was published in 2011, I believe. And in 2006, Mr. Carter published the book Desperate Networks, which was a behind-the-scenes look at how some of the biggest shows on television actually made it to air. Mr. Carter, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you guys.
I know we've brought you on to talk about the winter ratings and how cable and network are now equals day and date. You can find a hit anywhere. But I feel like we have to start with late night, because that's where so many people see your byline all the time. You cover that better than anyone. My first question is, NBC has fallen to second place in the morning news ratings after decades of being on top. During the February sweeps, it ranked 5th behind Univision by some standards. And so I'm just wondering why they would even think about fiddling with late night when that's the one time slot, the one day part where they're actually in first place a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's they're actually 3 places they finish first. One is nightly news, one is Leno, and the other is Saturday Night Live. And that's the only places they finish first. Yes, it's a very good question. Why, with all the problems they have on their plate, they would look to address a late night situation that is certainly not a crisis. Jay has about a year and a half left on his contract. Fall of 2014 is when his contract is up. And there's been a sense that he would move on at that point because, you know, he's obviously been at a long time and they want to move Jimmy Fallon in there. But they seem to have been pushing this a lot harder than you would think would make sense, given their other problems. And I did a story this weekend about the head of NBC Entertainment, Bob Greenblatt, was apparently so upset by jokes that Jay was making about their poor performance that he sent off a stinging email about this. And Jay responded saying, you know, I think this is what you do in late night. You make fun of your network when they're doing badly. And I just thought that was pretty extraordinary that they would get into that kind of a feud with a guy who's, you know, the last sort of one of the last pillars of strength for them. But it's been a kind of an ongoing story with Jay. You know, he does not really get a lot of respect. He gets ratings, but he doesn't get a lot of respect.
Well, I know. I mean, look, I mean, first off, I'm shocked that he even responded to an email. I'm surprised he has an email address over at NBC. But I guess...
Yeah, well, everybody's got an email address.
Yeah, that's...
I'm sure it's an internal one for him. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess he's right. I mean, in his response, he said, look, you know, making fun of their masters, making fun of the network that they're on is kind of a late night comedian's tradition. It dates all the way back to Carson.
I mean, it's part of the job description, really. I mean, if you think about it, he's supposed to talk about what's in the news every night. And, you know, the story of NBC finishing behind Univision was in the news. I know, because I wrote it. So him commenting on that can be totally predictable, as predicted and expected. And, you know, if you're a network, you got to roll with that. When you're doing poorly, your guy's going to make fun of you.
Yeah, I guess he said that, you know, how bad are the ratings that they've it's so bad. The Biggest Loser isn't just a TV show anymore. It's our new motto.
Right. That was one of the jokes. Yeah. And, you know, and when David Letterman was picking on Leslie Moonves at CBS when they were doing poorly, you know, Moonves wasn't happy to be picked on, but he didn't tell Dave to stop. It kind of is not, you know, consistent with what you should be thinking about as an entertainment boss, which is, you know, get the best ratings for your shows. Then everything will work out for themselves. They won't make jokes about you when your shows are doing well.
Well, and I guess this all comes after Leno. There was this news story about how, you know, NBC was thinking of maybe replacing Leno with Fallon. Didn't they try and do this just a couple years ago with Conan O'Brien? It didn't work then. Why would it work now?
Well, they did. Yeah, they gave, you know, Jay a 5-year end date, sell by date. And, you know, it went through the 5 years. Well, they wanted to keep Conan. That was part of their strategy. And I understood that. But then 5 years later, the circumstances had not really changed. Jay was still winning. And they went through with it and put Conan in there. And they were very unhappy and disappointed at his performance. And, of course, Jay didn't do anything in primetime. So they created another problem for themselves by doing that. I understand in a way that you don't want to be sitting with an older guy in late night when the younger next generation is moving in, and Jimmy Kimmel has moved into ABC, and they're a little worried about him becoming strong while their younger guy, Jimmy Fallon, is still on at late night. So they may want to make that change to get Fallon in there and competitive with Kimmel sooner rather than later. But it's at what cost? And if it's at the cost of, you know, going from first place to second or third in late night, at this point in time, it really doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for NBC.
Well, how is Kimmel doing? I mean, Kimmel was moved up from, I guess, 12 o'clock or 12:05 to 11:30. And he's doing better, I guess, in the 18 to 49 demo, but he's still coming in third place. This was supposed to be I don't know. I mean, was it smart to move Nightline back?
Yeah, I think they made the right move because it's a long-term play. And Kimmel is definitely getting a ton of attention, a lot of recognition. And, you know, I think he's doing a really good job, but his numbers aren't really there yet. Leno consistently wins not only the total viewer number, but he beats him in 18 to 49 pretty consistently, which is, I think, not what anyone expected. But everybody's never really grasped that Leno's strength is not in New York and L.A., which is where everybody writes about this stuff, but in the middle of the country. And in the middle of the country, he comes on at 10:35. So he builds up a bigger audience there. It's much more accessible at 10:35 than 11:35. And he plays well in St. Louis and Chicago and Minneapolis. You know, that's his strength. And, you know, the younger guys, the more hip guys, you know, they may play well in New York and L.A., but they may not play as well in the middle of the country as Jay does. And, you know, over time, I think Kimmel's going to be fine. I just think at the moment, you'd be kind of foolish if you're NBC and say, well, he's running my guy out of town. He's not doing that. He's not running Leno out of town.
But ABC went from first to third, and they're kind of happy about it because they did improve in the demos that advertisers care about most, which is 18 to 49. Do you think advertisers will ever wake up and realize that that somewhat narrow focus is kind of silly and outdated?
Here's the thing about that, and I don't think a lot of people really understand why they prefer that younger demographic. But it's not a matter of because people are going to establish their brands or things like other things that has been explained that way. It's really the notion of scarcity. People over 50 are very, very easy to reach on television. They're watching a lot of television, and you can reach them in a lot of different ways. People under 50, and especially 18 to 34 year olds, they watch much, much less television. So if you get a show that does appeal to them, a lot more advertisers will want to jump in there because they're going to reach an audience that they can't reach very easily otherwise. And so it's just a scarcity thing. They want to pay more to reach that audience because they can't reach them elsewhere. And there are certain products, movies and jeans and soft drinks, that you want to target that audience. So there are definitely advertisers that prefer that. And it's not because it's an age, you know, discrimination thing. it's business. They think it's important to reach younger people with certain products, and they're harder to reach, so they pay a premium to reach them. And if you're a network, you want to get that premium.
Well, the late night does seem rather crowded now. I mean, because not only do you have Leno, Letterman, and Kimmel, you also have Jon Stewart over at The Daily Show. Is there somebody who is viewed as the dominant player right now?
I think Stewart is, basically, because he actually wins in the demo over everybody. Now, he's on half hour earlier, which is an advantage. But, you know, for a smaller audience, he has a tremendous concentration of young viewers. And so their advertising rates can be, you know, consistently high. I think over time, though, John's longevity is open to question, too. I don't know how much longer he will want to do it, just because he seems to want to do other things, like he's directing a movie this summer. So that's kind of an interesting play, too. But I think John has to be put at the top now in terms, you know, he's hosted the Oscars twice. You know, he seems like, and he's won the Emmy 10 years in a row, for God's sakes. So, you know, I think his show is considered the gold standard now.
Late night is in turmoil. There's so many different people competing. The morning news race tended to be very stable for decades. Today's show was on top. There were a lot of stories to write about and changes of hosts and co-hosts. But right now, of course, after a lot of stability, there's a real battle going on. I don't know if it's a battle. Good Morning America is now number one after decades of the Today Show being on top. Are the long knives out at the Today Show? And why don't we hear more news about the idea of Meredith Vieira coming back now that her personal life has changed?
Well, I think they would love to have had Meredith come back, but she didn't want to do it. She wanted to step away from the job, and I don't think she really wants to devote full time to it. Plus, I think they now are invested in Savannah Guthrie, and they want to make her long-term the female host of the show. Look, on one level, you have to say it was very unnatural that Today Show would be able to win that many times.
Yeah.
I mean, they won every week for like 17 years, and then it was a week. So it's an extraordinary precedent-setting run, and eventually that's going to come to an end. Now, they bollocked up their transition horribly because they made a mistake. They had a deal to give Ann Curry the job. They promised her the job the next time, you know, it came open, and they didn't really want her in the job, to be honest. I think that was sort of a reluctant thing they did, and it didn't work out. It was not a good pairing, and believe me, the competition was thrilled when Ann got that job because they thought there was no chemistry with her and Matt Lauer. And then you're in a position where, okay, now we've put the woman in the job, it's not working, but now we have to move her out of the job, and that's going to tick off the audience because they're going to think we're throwing over the woman, which is, you know, always gets bad publicity in the morning. So, you know, all those things came together. At the same time, Good Morning America was reformatting its show, making it more populist. Some say tabloidy, you know, maybe dumbing it down a little bit and, you know, growing its appeal that way. So the two things came together. I think what's interesting is, though, that the Today Show is losing every week by, I don't know, 500,000 to 800,000 viewers. But in the demo and in news, that means 25 to 54 year olds. It's very close. And Today Show often still wins in that. So that show has inherent strength. And if you get the formula right, you win with the Today Show. Same with the Tonight Show. If you get the formula right, there's an inherent strength in being that, you know, classic show. And it'll be interesting to see if they stick, how long they stick with Matt Lauer, who, by the way, is excellent at the job. It's just now it's a question of, you know, whether the audience is mad at him, but he certainly can do the job. Or whether they'll decide they have to make a change because the numbers aren't coming back.
Yeah, and there's some rumors that he might head off to, I guess, Jeopardy, of all places.
Well, rumors get dropped all over the place, okay? I mean, the only reason I could see Matt Lauer doing that is if he really wanted to just spend most of his time playing golf. Because that's, you know, you can record four or five of those in a day. I mean, it's not really a full-time job, I don't think. Plus, it's in California. I don't think he wants to move to California. I wouldn't foresee him taking that job myself.
You also had a story this past week on the winter TV schedule and how it's kind of bringing a shift in the ratings race. And you pointed out that NBC was number one throughout the fall in, I guess, the category that most advertisers like that we just talked about, 18 to 49.
Right.
And they had the voice, they had football, so they had a lot going for them. Of course, now they're in fifth place, as we've mentioned. They're behind Univision. What is going on in the ratings race this winter?
Well, you know, it's not good for any of the networks, I'll tell you that. Nobody's really doing much. CBS is stable, and that's they've been able to do remarkably well over the past 3 years. But the other networks have had a real problem getting anything launched this year. Really, there is no hit show on anybody's schedule, no new one, no new hit show. And last year, there were several. And so I do think it's sort of a industry-wide problem. But NBC's situation is most acute because they rode the fall on the strength of a few items. One was NFL football, one was The Voice, and The Voice helped this new show revolution. So they had some things working, and they finished first, and they you know, started to feel like, hey, well, look, we've turned the corner. I think without realizing that, you know, without football on the air, that wasn't going to happen. And one of the reasons they finished first was the other guys were just doing so badly. So I do think they are in a critical moment here because, you know, they're going to bring The Voice back again for a second time in the same season. That's never been done with one of these singing competitions. Most people think it will be down from where it was in the fall. And some of the shows they've introduced have just been disastrously bad. This drama called Do No Harm set a new record low. And of course, Smash came back and was a complete disaster in the ratings. So NBC's got a lot of holes to fill.
Now, we're going to be talking about Smash a little later on, but I just assume there's no saving that show. That show is not going to get a third season.
It seems incomprehensible to me. I mean, they're sending it to Saturday night. That is the equivalent of, you know, going to St. Helena into exile.
But now, isn't that a little crazy, though, that the networks have this beachfront property on Saturday night, and they don't even bother to build a house on it? Because, of course, for many years, as you know, Saturday night generated lots of hits. And with DVRs, there's even less reason to think people would be unavailable to watch those shows. Why don't networks program on Saturday and to a big degree even on Friday nights?
Well, the viewing levels are down, there's no doubt, on Saturday night.
Because they only show reruns.
More so than, well, yeah, I mean, you could say the two things go hand in hand. But I think they also realize as time goes on that they have to cut back in general. And that's why you're seeing Friday is kind of getting that kind of treatment too. They just can't produce 22 hours anymore. It's too expensive. It's too much failure. And so I would expect them to try to do less, not more. So I don't think Saturday's ever going to come back. It's quite interesting though, that when you have an entire night with people just throw away, NBC can put on a show in the middle of the night on Saturday night and do better than anything they have in primetime. So, I mean, if you have the right product, it's still possible. It's just that's built in. Saturday Night is built in. Saturday Night Live is built into that. I just don't think anybody's going to go back into Saturday with anything meaningful.
Well, now, as the networks are cutting back on their original programming during primetime, it seems that the cable networks are actually increasing their spending on original programming, and they are just cleaning the floor with some of the networks, at least in the ratings.
No question. And you're seeing more cable networks decide that their business plan works best when they do originals and they don't buy repeats from the networks. You know, 5-10 years ago, you saw a few originals and nothing but network repeats on many, many channels. You're not seeing that anymore. I mean, the networks like History Channel and A&E, they don't want to have any acquisitions in. They want to be all original. Now, a lot of that is, you know, reality shows, but inexpensive. But they're also doing really quality, big-time programs. I mean, you know, if you look at, I mean, Walking Dead is now bigger than anything on any network in the 18 to 49 demographic. That's just an amazing, big, gigantic, honking hit show. And interestingly, it was originally pitched to NBC. And NBC kind of liked it, but they realized they couldn't put it on. They were hamstrung by their own standard because they couldn't have people having their brains blown out every week on the show. So they passed on it for content reasons, and now it's beating their brains in on cable. You know, and A&E can put on Bates Motel, which is an interesting new drama. And, you know, Mad Men is coming back, and Justified, and FX is an outstanding show. They're doing outstanding shows, and especially in drama, because they're willing to do, you know, closed ended seasons. We'll do 12 episodes and that's the end, and we won't repeat them, and they'll be serialized and people will watch them week after week and make appointments. And the networks still want to put on, you know, a cop show, which has a, you know, a murder at the beginning and the investigation, and they solve it at the end. And that's starting to feel really old hat to a lot of viewers because they're looking at these really great dramas, Breaking Bad and all these great dramas that are on cable.
Now, let me ask you a question. When you were growing up and the kids next to you were looking at the box scores of the baseball game, were you studying Nielsen ratings and wondering about the scheduling moves of Fred Silverman and people like that?
No, I was looking at the box scores.
You were. What did your fascination with Nielsen ratings and television network, did that follow from your beat?
I will say this. My dad was a humongous television watcher. He really watched a lot of television. And so I was exposed to a lot of shows because he had, you know, he'd watched everything. And so I had kind of an interest and a background in it, but I didn't pay any attention to the ratings or, you know, when a show I liked would be taken off, I'd be like, well, what happened? I like that show. You know,
what was the first show as a kid that you said, I cannot miss this show? I have to make sure I'm in front of the TV to catch this show every week.
Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. I would say. Yeah, that was a huge thing for my dad and my brother and I to watch together.
Well, now the New York Times has the bestseller list. It's probably the most prestigious bestseller list for books in the world. But for some reason, they've never really focused on like a box office chart for movies or album sales for music, or a TV ratings box where they do the top 40 shows of the week, or even a weekly column analyzing the ratings. Have you ever urged them or pushed them to try and do something like that?
Well, they did have a thing for a while where they broke down all of those things in a big stat page, but it was so, you know, buried, people didn't really know they were doing it much. We've talked about this actually with Nielsen, trying to get some sort of you know, something that would be specific to us. Nielsen has been interested, but they haven't come through with it yet. I mean, we'd like to do it. I mean, I don't think it's worth breaking it down for me to write about it endlessly, because many nights it's very standard. You know, you don't have to, oh, it's down 5% or it's up 5%. Or it's down 5%. That's not really worth a lot of my time to break that down. I tend to jump in when I see, you know, Smash came back down 30%, or American Idol is down 30%, or The Bible is, you know, gets 13 million people, you know, things that are out of the ordinary.
Well, usually there's one story a week that will jump out at you, and you could tell a story. It could be the Today Show or Late Night or soap operas in the afternoon or primetime. But here's something I can't find anywhere else, and if I could do it myself, I would. This podcast, we begin with the box office from around the world. We do a worldwide box office chart because that's what really matters for Hollywood, how much a movie grosses worldwide. So instead of saying the box office for North America, we add up the box office in Japan and China and Germany and UK, and we give the number one movie around the world. It's kind of like in America, if you said, well, why give the number one movie in Florida or California? Those are good markets, but what matters is North America. So we do a box office chart for the entire world. What I'd love to see is a chart for the top shows of the week, even if it just focused on prime time, that included all the shows. What you see is the top shows on network, and then sometimes you see a separate chart for cable. But as you and I know, if you listed the actual top 20 or 40 or 50 shows of the week, in the top 10 2 weeks ago, you would have had The Bible at number 4, The Walking Dead at number 5. Last week, you would have had Saturday Night Live at number 10 if you included late night. Right. And when people are watching television, they don't care what channel it's on or what time of the day it airs. They just want to know what the most popular shows of the week are. And that's something you can't find anywhere else.
But I will tell you what I think is now a gigantic complication in television ratings, and that's delayed viewing, because, you know, we report what happens. Increasingly, what we report the next day is superseded at, you know, the end of a week by shows that add 30, 40% more viewers. And you have to really, especially, you know, when you have a marginal show that you think might be canceled, you better look at how it's doing over time, because some of them add so much in terms of delayed viewing that they become, you know, viable, quite viable if you look at that rating. But again, you don't want to report the ratings three different times, and that's what it would require. You want to report what happened the night before. You want to report after 3 days, because that's the commercial thing, and then you want to report after 7 days. Because that you get a 7-day report too. So, I think over time, it's all based on the 7 days. And that's another thing. You try to compare what's this done all season to what it did last night. Well, all season, it's already included all the delayed viewing. So it's much, much harder than it used to be to make those comparisons.
Could you not just do once a week and say, hey, over the past 7 days, all the delayed viewing is in now. Here's the top, I don't know, 25 shows that were were on television.
Yes, I think that's going to be the way to do it. But then, but you know, we're going to get into streaming and everything else too. So, you know, it's going to be very hard to do over time how we're going to measure this. How do we measure how House of Cards is doing on Netflix?
They won't tell you. Yeah, well, I think it's going to be like the Billboard charts in a way where, you know, today they're measuring just sales, and then tomorrow they're measuring sales plus streaming, and then 3 days from now they're measuring sales plus streaming plus YouTube views, and you never really know what the chart is representing. In fact, when I read some of your columns and I hear, oh, you know, some show got a 2.3 rating, I think, wow, that's, I have no idea what that means. Is that 300 million people or two people? I've got no idea. I mean, that I know it does mean something, but I can never figure out precisely what a 3.1 rating is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we only do that now in 18 to 49. For some reason, that's what they report. We always report the total viewer figure in terms of its, you know, millions of viewers. And occasionally I will include the math, which is, if you really want to know, in 18 to 49, it's 1.256 million for each rating point.
So it's kind of like a Celsius Fahrenheit conversion. You have to...
Kind of.
Yeah, it's not a one-to-one ratio. I did not know that, and so thank you very much. I knew that there was a ratio, I just didn't know what it was. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the segment here, you wrote this book in 1994 called The Late Shift, and that was when, you know, there was this battle between Leno and Letterman. Have you given any thought to maybe writing another book about the current late night wars?
Well, you know, I did another one in 2010 about the Conan Jay fiasco.
Right.
And that fit very well, and people really like that. And I always say I will write it when it's really a story, and I want, you know, I don't know how this is going to play out this time. My sense is that they're going to make a change, maybe sooner rather than later, or at least announce a change, taking Leno out of there. And then the question becomes, what does CBS do with take Leno out, then what does CBS do with Letterman? You know, he also should probably consider stepping away, and then you wonder, where does CBS go from there? I don't know if they'll just slide Craig Ferguson up there. I think they may try to put someone in New York again. It could be very interesting. I think Jimmy Fallon, for example, doesn't want to move to Los Angeles and do the Tonight Show there, and especially because apparently Kimmel is really doing a great job booking Los Angeles. So all of that's kind of interesting, and I just don't know yet whether it's a drama. In order for it to be a book, there has to be some very interesting conflict.
And yet none of us are talking about Conan O'Brien, so that should tell you
unfortunately, it says something. I mean, Conan, who I think is a terrific guy and a big talent, and I've always been a fan of his, you know, he's under the radar at TBS. I mean, it's just no other way I can say it. I mean, that's not a network that people talk about, you know, and he also has the problem of being on at the same time as Jon Stewart, and Stewart gets so much attention. He sucks up so much attention. I know that Conan and his staff are very happy because they have no interference and they're allowed to do things. They're taking the show to Atlanta in April. You know, so they're doing fine in that way, but I don't get the sense that his profile is nearly as high as it was.
Are you working on any other books or projects at the moment?
Yeah, I'm sort of working on a project, but I'm going to keep that to myself.
Okay, too early. And should we plug, are you on Twitter? Should we be mentioning whether people should be following you on Twitter?
Yes, people should follow me at WJ Carter.
WJ Carter. Okay, well, Bill Carter from the New York Times joining us from the newsroom. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, not only about this winter's ratings, but also late night and the early morning news wars. Thank you very much.
All right. Nice to be with you guys.
Well, that was good of him to join us. I've wanted to talk to Bill Carter for years. I've been reading his writing for a long time. He's a terrific reporter. He has every contact possible in television. I'm sure he can get anyone on the phone, and he always breaks a lot of good stories and has really strong reporting. And The Late Night Wars is a classic of television reporting.
Yeah, great book. You should pick it up if you can.
But I have to say, you know, I think when we talk about the TV ratings chart and how to do that, there are a lot of complicated issues today, and it's different than it would have been to do 20 years ago. But you look at Billboard and what they do with their music chart, especially with their top 100, Hot 100 singles. When they devise a song's popularity, they use a lot of different, you know, pieces into the mix. They create a formula based on radio airplay and sales and now YouTube plays and all sorts of other metrics. And they're constantly fiddling with that to try and reflect what actually is the most popular thing on the radio. I think TV is a little easier than that, but there are a lot of moving parts, such as streaming and playing stuff on Hulu and things like that. But that's okay. You know, if you can get a chart 10 days after the week is over, and you've got a very comprehensive chart with at least live plus three DVR ratings and incorporating as much as you can from other material, at least that's a better picture than we're getting now. You know, right now we have no idea. People, I've never seen a top 10 list of the shows of the week that included The Bible and The Walking Dead and Saturday Night Live and all those things that deserve to be on there because they are reaching that many people.
So let me ask, when you see one of these charts for TV or when you see a story
lies,
about,
I say, lies. It's all lies.
So then you're just like, eh, who cares?
Well, it's just misleading. You see CBS, you know, NBC is not even in the top 30, when in fact, Saturday Night Live was the 10th ranked highest show of the week 2 weeks ago.
In fact, that is one of our stories in Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. You really want me to sing this, Michael?
Please.
I'm not going to sing this, but basically, it's about Vevo TV.
Talk to me.
Well, Vevo is looking to go where MTV once went.
I want my Vevo
TV. The online source for music videos has a major presence with YouTube. Viewers searching for music videos on that site often get sent to Vevo-hosted content where official postings from artists can be found. Looking for Justin Timberlake's latest on YouTube? They'll link you to Vevo. But now Vevo thinks viewers have too many choices and are looking for a little curating. They're launching an online channel that will include hour-long blocks of music videos focused on a certain artist or a certain style, a certain genre. And those videos aren't selected by an algorithm or your previous history or users using, you know, users who vote. Sometimes you can get that in there as well on YouTube. They're going to be chosen by actual humans. Go figure. Let's call them, modern-day VJs? The service is available now, and Vevo thinks it will be popular for people hosting parties or just looking to spin some music a la radio. What is that, Michael? This radio you speak of?
Keep going.
Okay. The service is available now, and Vevo thinks it will be popular for people hosting parties or just looking to spin some music a la radio and MTV without having to constantly create their own playlists. Vevo hopes to launch a cable channel version by the end of the year. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because Vevo and YouTube is a marriage of convenience, and it's not going to last forever, and Vevo knows that, and they need to look to the future. So they're also saying, yeah, you know, if you know what song you want to hear, you can go to YouTube or Vevo, type in a song title, and you will find the video right away and be able to hear that song. For almost anything, even if there's no video, they'll have a lyric video so you can hear the actual audio of the song. And that's what a lot of people do right now. But they realize, hey, sometimes you don't know what you want to hear. You just want to listen to something or watch something. And videos are kind of cool. And you can't go to MTV to watch videos. So they say, hey, let's create a cable website where we actually show you what we think the cool videos are. And guess what? Maybe we'll launch a cable channel. What a thought. Since MTV is not doing that anymore, it's been a long time since they've been known for music videos. There's an opportunity there. So if Vevo can get on cable, which is hard because it's hard to get that real estate, they think maybe they can provide a service that MTV stopped offering long ago.
Well, we'll see if it works out. But here's a sign of changing times. The simple fact that Quentin Tarantino's movie Django Unchained will be released in China made headlines on The Hollywood Reporter. It's the first time by Tarantino to get an official release in that country, China that is. This points, of course, to the ever-expanding importance of the worldwide box office and China in particular, even though we can't seem to get any numbers out of it. The movie is set to be released on April 11th and hopes to add to its $402 million worldwide box office, 65% of that coming from outside North America. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's $407 million now because we just updated those figures. We had missed a few little countries over this weekend. It's a big deal. It's symbolic big deal, not for Tarantino, but the fact that more and more every movie is getting released in China. You're seeing that for a lot of big Hollywood films. The barriers are coming down. How much money Hollywood's getting out of China? That I'd like to hear. We know what they're grossing in that country. How much do they actually get to bring out of China back to America? That would be interesting to hear.
Well, do you think it's symbolic that Ennio Morricone, who is a composer who, you know, he's supplied some of, you know, he's been a composer for 500 films, let's put it that way, and predominantly known for working with Sergio Leone, who's, you know, all that spaghetti Western music. He provided some of that spaghetti Western whistling music for Django Unchained, but the composer, talking to some students in Rome, said, that's it. He's no longer working with Tarantino because he just uses music without any kind of cohesiveness.
What? Morricone is known for much more than just spaghetti Western. Certainly, that's some of his most iconic music, but
right.
He's done tremendously great scores for all sorts of major directors. Roland Joffé's The Mission is one of the great film scores of all time. He's worked with Oliver Stone, lots of other people, Bernardo Bertolucci. But yes, the from the, you know, Good, the Bad, the Ugly and A Fistful of Dollars, that's some of his most famous work. But, you know, he's a master, but he's also 84 and clearly, you know, I don't know what he's talking about. Tarantino's known for using music with great care, in fact. So I don't know what his complaint was about this movie. It was an homage and tribute to spaghetti Westerns. I don't know what his, you know, take on it was or why he felt the music wasn't used well. If anybody had a complaint, it was Jim Croce. But it's a big whoop.
Yeah, well, and you should say that Jim Croce, his songs were used.
Yeah, it's one song used in the film. I got it. There were often pop songs used rather incongruously in spaghetti Westerns in the 70s. They just sort of grab a pop tune and throw it in there. And that's sort of what he did here to good effect. It actually resonated with the characters and their growing friendship. Nonetheless, it felt a little out of place, but in a fun, knowing sort of way, because that's what a lot of other spaghetti Westerns did. So if there was any piece of music that seemed incongruous, it was that pop song by Jim Croce. But Tarantino was just doing what a lot of the cheaper spaghetti Westerns did in that era. So it made sense.
Serialized TV dramas don't repeat well, at least in syndication they don't, because of course the story doesn't make much sense unless you watch the episodes in order. So Law & Order is one of the biggest syndicated hits of all time, whereas the lauded Hill Street Blues was a total flop and other shows like ER always underperformed. But thanks to streaming services, serialized dramas are easier to watch than ever, and that's leading some very creative, it's leading to all these interesting deals that we've been talking about in the past. The Good Wife on CBS may just show the way of the future for shows like that. The acclaimed drama starring Juliana Margulies has its first three seasons, which are just debuting on Amazon Instant or Amazon Prime Video. I don't know what they call it. That happened last week. Hulu Plus starts showing the first three seasons in September, and the Hallmark Channel will start airing episodes in January of 2014, or you can buy the first three seasons for about $85 on DVD at Amazon. You can expect more creative deals like this in the future. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, I think it's creative. It's showing, hey, let's get this on as many platforms as possible.
So the big deal here is that it's not exclusive.
Well, I think that's the most important thing to
me.
The mistake that some people make is, all right, we'll just sell it to Amazon Prime and put it on their instant video. Let's make it exclusive to Hulu Plus. Most people, they just want to look for a show on the outlet that they like. They don't want to worry about whether it's at Blockbuster or Walmart. Just make it available everywhere. So it's sort of a platform release. It starts out at Amazon Prime on their instant video service. Then a few months later, it goes to Hulu Plus and it'll be available on both of them. You can probably stream it some other places. You can buy it on DVD. You can rent the DVDs, I'm sure, from...
So everything I just said.
Right.
yeah.
But the point is, it's platformed, it goes out there, it's on as many services as possible, it doesn't limit itself to one of them, and because it's a serialized drama, you want to get it out to as many outlets as soon as possible, because they know, like, I haven't been watching The Good Wife, and I've been thinking I should catch up with it, and when I'm ready to, I can dive in, watch three or four seasons, and be ready to go for next fall to catch up on season five.
You must have a lot of time on your hands, watching three or four seasons.
It doesn't take that long. It's 60 episodes, you watch two episodes a night. For a few weeks, pretty much you catch up in a season in a week or two. And, you know, it doesn't, then you take a break and you watch another season. It goes pretty quick. They're about 42 minutes an episode when they're prime time like that. So, you know, I'm watching Borgen right now, a Danish drama. It's 10 episodes. They're an hour long each, a solid hour. But, you know, in 10 days, I will have seen the whole series.
Well, this is our next story is a follow-up on something we spoke about last week. Random House has made some substantial moves to appease all these angry writers that we talked about over the proposed contracts for its Hydra imprint. The sci-fi focus label had come up with a scheme that involved no advances and forcing writers to pay for all sorts of services that publishers traditionally paid for. It said writers would get a better royalty, but they also rejiggered how the income would be measured. Random House says writers can choose a more traditional model of advanced versus royalties at a lower rate and tweak some of the more onerous and objectionable details. The main pressure group, the Science Fiction Writers of America, responded that some of the changes were indeed substantial and hope to keep working with them. And that the them in this case is Random House. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I think it was a poorly thought out idea of a contract. There was a lot of blowback, a lot of negative response from the publishing industry, and they reacted quickly, which was smart. They said, all right, people are really angry. They're going to make us the bad dog in this. They didn't back away completely. They just said, well, if you don't want this, you can choose another contract. So, you know, they sort of appeased people that way. They haven't backed down from the idea of offering this contract, but they're like saying, oh, if you really don't like this, you'll have the option of a more traditional contract. The fact is, somebody asked them, well, hey, has any writer that you already have under contract said, gee, this contract is so much better. Can I switch to the new formula? And they said, well, no, actually, nobody's asked for that. So clearly, if you have enough sway, you can get the more traditional contract. That's what you want. So I don't think it'll fly long term, but we're going to see more and more stuff from like this from smaller imprints down the road.
Disney paid $4 billion to acquire Lucasfilm, and they are making clear that they're keeping all the toys to play with by themselves. They don't want anybody else in their toy box. That means the critically acclaimed hit series Clone Wars has been canceled, even though it's a hit and Cartoon Network would love more episodes. Further, the spoof Star Wars Detours, co-created by Seth Green, has been, quote-unquote, delayed, i.e. they're never making it, which is another way of saying, of course, it's not going to happen. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It makes sense. Disney paid a lot of money for Lucasfilm. They want all the projects in-house. Someone said, oh, why did they cancel this Seth Green thing? He's the guy who does Chicken Wars, and they've done a series
Chicken
of
Wars? You mean Chicken Robot?
Chicken Wars.
Robot Chicken, or one of those things.
Robot Chicken, which has had annual spoofs of the Star Wars movies with the blessing of George Lucas and people doing voices, stuff like that. A loving annual spoof of Star Wars. And they finally established a whole series they were going to do called Star Wars Detours, which also had the blessing of George Lucas. Disney stepped in and said, ah, never mind about that. And people said, oh my God, Disney has no sense of humor. They're not willing to be spoofed. They're very sensitive about their properties. I'm like, I don't really think that's it. I think it's just, hey, we don't want anybody else to get to make movies and TV shows and comic books off our property. We want to do it ourselves.
That's kind of why you spend $4 billion on intellectual property.
Exactly. And that's why Fox is churning out all the Marvel movies they can while they have the rights to them. Because they have Spider-Man. They have these other movies.
Not Spider-Man. They have X-Men.
Oh, Sony has Spider-Man. Fox has X-Men and some other properties, and they all know they have to make as many of them as they can before their rights to the franchise run out, because Disney is not going to renew them. Not a chance in heck. They're going to want to bring those movies in-house. Even if it takes 10, 15 years, that's what they're going to do. So you got to make them while you can.
That's true. Now, Veronica Mars, the movie, has been a passion project for fans, star Kristen Bell, and its creator, Rob Thomas. The studios? Not so much. So after years of frustration, Thomas has now turned to Kickstarter. If you could raise $2 million in 30 days, Warner Brothers said they would go forward with at least this, you know, a low-budget version of the film. $2 million, by the way, is less than studios spend on 1 hour of primetime drama on a major network. Thomas launched the offer on March 13th with all sorts of inducements at certain price points, all these rewards such as PDF of the script at $10, a digital download of the movie within days of its release for $35, and more elaborate offers like having Bell and Thomas follow you on Facebook and Twitter, having, you know, Bell record your voicemail message and a walk-on part in the movie, your usual Kickstarter premiums. It began on March 13th and ended hours later with more than $2.2 million pledged by some 20,000 plus fans. Of course, the more money they raise, the better the movie they can make. As of showtime, they were at 55,000 pledges, totaling $3.6 million. Warner Brothers has said this would mean they'd commit to, what, prints and advertising for the release? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop.
What?
Do you know why?
Because I think it's a one-off. In my opinion, it's a one-off.
This is not the wave of the future. People are not going to want to start funding future films for people. They had actual gifts that they were giving them, T-shirts, digital downloads of the movie, you know, a little fun access, walk-on parts. Great idea. Most movies, of course, would never, ever have a fan base that could do that sort of thing. So this is a very unusual project. It makes sense for this movie. It's wonderful that they did it. If they don't get up to $5 or $8 or $10 million, it's not going to be a very good movie on a budget wise. maybe Kristen Bell and Rob Thomas will kick in some money to make it a little bit better as far as the budget that they have to play with. But this isn't the wave of the future or anything like that. Though I will say there have been some other shows and people who said, gee, can we do this? The creator of Pushing Daisies immediately called his agent and said, can we do a Kickstarter for our Pushing Daisies feature film? He's written like a third of the budget already. So he called up Barry Levinson, who was a producer on the show, and said, hey, what about Pushing Daisies, said Brian Fuller. Can't we make this happen? And Barry said, you might want to talk to the studio about that. So right. It's not so easy. It's not so simple. There are a few little passion projects like this. Maybe Buffy would have been a feature film long ago if this had been possible. So maybe that'll happen again. Who knows? But this is not some sort of trend where suddenly studios can say, oh, we don't have to pay to have the new Spider-Man movie. Fans will be happy to kick in money.
So, if you want a successful Kickstarter campaign, here's what you do. First, you get like one of the most sought after showrunners in the business. Okay, so let's do that. Then get a very well-known actress to be in your film. And
First, create a beloved series.
Right.
That is a cult hit and that never had quite the due it deserved or never quite got to finish itself properly. That's number one. That's all you got to do. Create a great show.
I love what Thomas Gawicki from Warner Brothers Digital Distribution said. He said, when Rob came to us with the Kickstarter idea, we saw a unique opportunity to take a fantastic product, a wonderful universe that has so much richness and depth to it, and to try to have a new approach to how we do these projects. Hey, if it was so great, why'd you cancel it?
Yeah, right. So it's like, a great idea. Let the fans pay for it.
Right. Well, and in all fairness, it wasn't Warner Brothers that canceled it. I'm not mistaken, it was the network that canceled it.
Yeah, the studio would have been happy. Yeah, but it was the CW. Was it the WB at the time?
I don't know.
I don't know. Whatever.
It was only on the air for 3 years. But in any case, speaking of shows that are only on the air for a short period of time, NBC announced a bunch of mid-season schedule changes. The most notable? They're moving the Broadway drama Smash, i.e. the show that Sperling likes, to Siberia. Did I say Siberia? Wait, no, I mean Saturdays, which is essentially the same thing. In happier news, the Matthew Perry comedy Go On gets a shot on Thursdays at 9:30 p.m. In a sign of how few shows NBC has, they're rerunning the hit singing competition series The Voice on Sundays. Not Sundays at 7, but Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. 3 hours of reruns on Sunday night, the biggest night of the week for viewership. So is Smash moving to Saturdays a big deal or a big whoop? Michael, let me take this one. It's a big deal.
Yeah, no, it's a big whoop because the show was already dead in the water. It's just making official what we already knew. However,
you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start a Kickstarter campaign.
To save Smash?
To save Smash.
You get to appear in a Broadway show. 3 hours of The Voice reruns on Sunday night. When I read that, I thought, they mean 7 to 8, that corner of a dead hour when most networks, don't want to compete against 60 minutes.
Yeah.
But no. Oh, my God. Sunday night is the biggest night of television. More people watch TV on Sunday night than any other night of the week. Viewership levels are always highest on Sunday. And NBC's going to show reruns? That's their plan? That is unbelievable.
Well, Saturday nights usually belong to Saturday Night Live, and Justin Timberlake was leaving no stone unturned in his quest to let the world know he has a new album coming out. Did you know that, Michael?
I did.
I didn't. Grammys.
In fact, they're
Saturday
now
night
saying
night.
He's going to release another album in the fall.
Wow.
Anyway.
He's just too busy for words. Timberlake performed 2 songs on the Grammy Awards. He spent a week performing on Jimmy Kimmel, doing skits and a new song every night. He's been here, there, and everywhere doing press. And to top it all off, he was the host and musical guest on Saturday Night Live. Last week. He pushed the show to a 14-month high in the ratings with more than 8 million viewers. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a big deal for him and a big deal for the show. And as we talked to Bill Carter about it, this would have been the 10th ranked show of the week. Of all the shows that people watched the week that this aired, it would have been number 10 above almost everything else on network television. It would have been NBC's number one rated show. So the fact that you don't include that in the ratings, to me, it's really, really misleading. It has to end. Somebody smart will do it, go to the effort of making the best chart they can, and that's going to really revolutionize the way people think about what the popular shows are on television.
I'm going to start a Kickstarter campaign. Taking the complete opposite approach.
Made me laugh.
Yeah, finally. Took about 186 shows, but finally got one laugh. So we have Timberlake, who's everywhere. Then we have the opposite approach over here. with David Bowie, the iconic musical artist and actor, and he does everything. His new album just debuted in the UK and actually in the US. It'll hit the US charts next week, but Bowie kept the entire project under wraps and hasn't given a single interview or made one media appearance to promote the project, even though this is his first album in 10 years and it's been a long time since Bowie ruled the charts. Nonetheless, the album has debuted at number one in the UK with 90,000 copies sold, making the next day his first number one in the country in, 20 years. In the U.S., Billboard predicts it will debut at number two, just behind, Bon Jovi. Don't fret, that will be his highest charting album ever in the U.S., since the highest Bowie ever has ever reached on these charts is number three, with Station to Station back in 1976. He's also enjoying strong reviews and the best week of album sales since the SoundScan era began in 1991. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. It's great for David Bowie. I can't believe that Let's Dance didn't chart higher, but apparently it only reached number four on the charts.
Oh, I was wondering where that one went. 1983 is when that album was released, and it's got to be his best-selling album ever, don't you think?
No, I'm not sure about
Ziggy
that.
Ziggy Stardust.
Well, he's never been a big seller. Let's be clear. Okay. You know, he's never been a huge seller. Most of his albums have never gone platinum or gold. So Space Oddity has never even been certified gold in the North America. So I don't know how much it's sold, but it's one of those albums that is wildly influential, way beyond what its sales are. Let's Dance only went platinum, according to this. I would have thought it was double or triple, the chart I'm looking at. Okay. I would have thought it would have gone at least double or triple platinum. I'd have to look at my Billboard charts. But he's never been a huge hit. That was sort of an unusual album for him. The fact that it did have a number of big hit singles and was a bestseller on the charts, you know, that was not a usual position for Bowie. He's always been more influential than best-selling. Nonetheless, it's great to see at this stage in his career, when we thought perhaps he'd retired and was never going to record any music again, that he's got a new album out. It's getting very good reviews and genuinely charting very strongly, showing there's a lot of love and affection for him and appreciation for his music.
You know what I love about this show, besides the fact that it takes 186 episodes to make you laugh, I don't know what episode it was that we reported that David Bowie has said he's not going to record any more music, that he's done, he's retired. And now, you know, we've been around so long that we're actually recording a story.
His comeback.
Yeah, his comeback. Go figure. Well, but that kind of brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week we're going to be talking about Twitter and you have a Twitter account, Michael, right?
I do have a Twitter account.
And, you can follow Bill Carter.
That's right. I can follow Bill Carter.
And now maybe you could also get this standalone music app that they're creating. I'm a big fan.
I don't think you need a Twitter account to do that, do you?
I don't know. I think you might have to. I'm a big fan of a website called We Are Hunted, and it's kind of they go out and they search all these blogs and they create this chart of music that's trending, usually emerging artists or new music, music that, you know, David Bowie was on there, I think, a while back. And it's a really great website. Of course, now it's down because they were acquired by Twitter, and they're using Twitter is using the We Are Hunted technology to build its own iOS app that is basically Twitter music.
Huh. So it's a standalone app. You download it to your smartphone. And how does it, is it a streaming radio service, or is it music you choose what you want to listen to, or how does it work?
Well, it's got these four tabs in it, and it's going to use SoundCloud for the music. So they're not going to have to license any music. They're using another service, SoundCloud. You know, the service that last week you said was horrible and was never going to last.
I didn't say it was horrible. I just said it's not the wave of the future.
Okay. Well, it has four tabs in it. A suggested, which recommends songs and artists based on whoever you're following and artists that you're following. So if you're following David Bowie, it might have music for you there. Then Now Playing will bring in links to songs tweeted by the people you follow and who tweet using the hashtag Now Playing. Then there's a popular tab, which brings in songs trending on We Are Hunted. So hopefully they'll bring that back. That website. And then there's an emerging tab, which tracks all these up and coming artists. So it's got four tabs. You know, the breadth of people who are emerging to people you're following, and it pulls all this music in from from SoundCloud. I wonder if you can use it offline or whether it has to be using your data or whether they'll create a desktop app so you can use it at home.
We'll have to see. And who knows what the royalty rates are. Here's what I find fascinating.
Well, SoundCloud will pay the royalty rates because it's coming from SoundCloud. So,
well, but SoundCloud isn't, they must have a deal, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they absolutely have a
deal. Right. I mean, SoundCloud's not going to want to suddenly provide them a royalty-free music so right. they can make money off their ads. Presumably, there'll be ads somewhere, right?
I would imagine, yes.
I mean, how else are they going to make money? It's free, you said.
Yes, it does say, it does seem to be free.
So that's what I find fascinating. Nobody's making money off streaming music. Nobody's making money off subscription music. That's where you pay a monthly fee and you get access to music, whether it's a radio or you decide what songs you want to listen to. Whatever the service is, Spotify, Pandora, We Are Hunted, whatever this is called, all the others. Nobody's making money yet on all of this, but everybody wants in the game. Amazon, Google, Apple, Twitter, everybody wants a piece of the music puzzle. They know that music is a huge draw online. People love listening to music. They love discovering new music. They love access to music. And they're not buying CDs, and they think this is the wave of the future. Nobody's quite figured out how to make money off of it, but they all know there's money to be made somewhere down the road.
Well, think about it. You've got all of these music stars and musicians on Twitter that have millions of followers. So really, I mean, music on all of these social networking sites attracts people. And when you attract people, you can market to them and you can make money. So they, you know, they basically, all of these services, whether it's Spotify or Twitter Music, they don't want their young mainstream users to go someplace else. And so, since music seems to be attracting people, they're all trying to get into music in some way, shape, or form.
So we'll have to see how this service works once it launches. It may launch within a month.
Right.
All I think about SoundCloud is just that when I've gone there, it's just been a link provided to me by a record label. And they have sort of this weird graph, and you can listen to the song. It's fine, just like you used to be able to go to MySpace, type in an artist name, and find a song immediately. Now you can go to YouTube, type in an artist name, and find the song you want immediately, a new release typically. So SoundCloud to me was just this little technological service. It wasn't a site that you stayed on and played with and created stuff out of. It was just, to me, just a sort of a backroom ability to play music and post comments about the song. That's why I've always felt SoundCloud was not some big player.
Well, and it's becoming more and more a big player.
Well, in the back room.
Well, in the back room, and they are, I don't know if it's back room only. I think that, you know, I go there to find music now.
What do you mean? You go there to type in a song and hear it?
Yes.
You don't go there to discover music?
I do at times, yes, depending on who.
How?
Well, I have followers there that, and on SoundCloud, and I follow others. So what they're uploading.
Why don't you go to MySpace and follow Justin Timberlake? He has a piece of that puzzle, right?
Yeah, because then I'd have to go to MySpace, and then I'd have to figure out how to like set up my account again and figure out what I was doing. And, you know, come on, how much time do I have, really?
Well, I don't know if you should follow David Bowie because he's not playing the multimedia game right now. But in fact, it's accurate. Wikipedia had it right. Of course, he's never gone more than platinum for any album. He only has three or four albums that have gone platinum. And those are Let's Dance, the follow-up Tonight, which had a great duet with Tina Turner on the title track, and Changes One Bowie and Changes Bowie, which were both greatest hits compilations. Those are his best-selling albums in North America. They've gone platinum, which means they've sold a million copies. Most of his albums have never even gone gold, including, Ziggy Stardust has gone gold.
Yeah, so I was going to say that.
Wikipedia needs updating on that. So he's got four or five or six gold albums, three platinum albums, four platinum albums, and that's it. So this is an artist whose importance has never been equaled by his album sales.
Well, at least we weren't wrong. You know, we're able to correct ourselves mid-show.
Correct Wikipedia.
And yeah, we're even able to correct Wikipedia. You know what? I'm going to get that Jonathan Rogers guy. I'm going to get him onto Wikipedia.
All right.
Yes, that's right. It's my way of segueing into our listener email, which is to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And for 2 weeks now, I've been mentioning this email, and I hope Jonathan doesn't think we're making fun of him. It's quite the opposite. I was actually very glad to receive
this. Why would
you
think we're making fun of him?
I don't know. I have no
idea. Well, he's addressed to you, not to me, so clearly you should read it.
Brother. Well, he writes, Sperling, I have been listening to your podcast. I don't know why I'm reading it in a tone that's like punitive. I have been listening to your podcast for about a year now and really enjoy it. Well, Jonathan, thank you very much.
And I enjoy, thank you too, even though you didn't mention me.
However, I have heard you make the same mistake over and over now, and I want to finally point it out in the hopes you cease.
Now, I bet I've made the mistake too.
When he got to this point, I was like, I bet you I know what he's going to say. And sure
really?
Enough. Yes, because every time I'm doing post on the show, I'm like, oh gosh, we always confuse this issue.
Oh.
But yet we correct it when we're talking about DreamWorks. He writes, in the most recent episode, which I believe was episode 184, you discussed how Cablevision was suing Viacom for their bundling requirements. You then made a reference that Comcast would never do this because they own NBC, and that Time Warner Cable would never do this because of their ties to Time Warner. Yes. Time Warner spun off Time Warner Cable in 2009, kind of like they just did with Time Inc. They have no ties to each other for whatever reason, probably marketing and brand recognition. They didn't change their name, but there is no corporate connection between Time Warner and Time Warner Cable. And he, I guess...
Yikes, he's absolutely right.
Yes, he has a piece from Wikipedia here, which we'll place in the show notes. He says, second, I wanted to address your story regarding Spotify and Ford cars. Michael asked how the car accessed the Spotify service. You admitted you didn't know. Michael suggested that maybe they used a system similar to Amazon's free service on Kindle, which you dismissed as untrue. Amazon does offer a free ebook download service for their Kindles. It is called WhisperNet. They worked out a deal with Sprint a while back that allows their Kindles to download very simple small things like ebooks and text for free for the lifetime of the device. In fact, yes, indeed, I did know that. Now, as far as the Ford cars, their announcement regarding Spotify is that the Spotify app on iPhones and Android phones will sync to their Dash radio interface. Therefore, all it really is doing is using the phone's wireless data and app and just displaying the information about songs, etc., on the screen, letting you interact with the app on your touchscreen of the car dash. That's how Ford gets data without charging you. Anyway, hope this is clear. This clears up a few points. Jonathan Rogers. Now, I would like to say a couple things.
Thank you for writing, and he's absolutely correct.
Right. That is correct. And every time I'm listening to the show as I'm doing post and we get to this, I'm like, oh, Time Warner, I hate it when companies do this. And by the way, I worked for a company that did this, and I complained bitterly when this happened, when there was a DTS Inc. and a DTS Digital Cinema, which was a spinoff of the original company. Neither of the companies were related. The companies were always confused in the media and by our customers. It was a pain in the neck.
But there's value of money in the name, and so neither one of them wanted to give it up.
That's right. And the same thing with DreamWorks and DreamWorks Animation. It's very confusing. And I'm always, when we're talking about Time Warner, I'm always forgetting that Time Warner and Time Warner Cable are different and that you actually have to say Time Warner Cable.
So to be clear, DreamWorks is the studio that did live-action films.
That's right.
DreamWorks Animation is the studio that screwed over its animators by shipping Kung Fu Panda 3 overseas and firing a bunch of its employees and blaming it on another movie that they made. Meanwhile, Time Warner is the company that's having a terrible time at the box office because all their movies are doing dreadfully this year, and they're really looking forward to the next Hobbit movie because God knows that's the brightest light they have on the horizon. Meanwhile, Time Warner Cable is the company that charges me way too much money for phone and internet access.
Right, and WhisperNet, which I did know about, and what I was saying was not true, is that I did not think that Ford would add a data service like WhisperNet to their cars. I didn't think they would do that, which apparently they're not.
So they're just accessing your smartphone.
They're just accessing your smartphone. And what's great about WhisperNet is if you're on your phone and you're reading a book, Moby Dick, and you get into, you're on page 220, you can then pick it up on your iPad or on your Kindle, and it will be on the same page. It syncs up wherever you were between devices. WhisperNet is actually quite neat.
Well, it does when it works properly, though it's not working properly for me. And I'm seeing a lot of other people who I went online to explore the problem. They say, oh, you have to uninstall this and unclick this, and then it does that, but you have to do it every time or it won't sync it up. So I only really read on my Kindle, so it's not an issue. I don't read on my iPhone as well. And the Kindle charge lasts for so long, it's not really a case of needing to. And I always have it with me. But it is a useful service for downloading. I wonder if Sprint regrets the deal, because by God, there are a lot of Kindles sold and there must be a lot of downloading of ebooks.
Yeah, I mean, I always wondered whether they would one day kind of try and phase that out, and I don't think they have. I could be wrong.
Well, but I really appreciate him writing in. Hopefully, I will remember now, just like I've forgotten the phrase that hopefully I don't get wrong in the future, whatever that was. Perhaps when I say that phrase, I'll correct myself these days, but I will try to remember in the future, Time Warner is not the same as Time Warner Cable. When I curse them, it's usually Time Warner Cable, I mean.
Yes, and I don't know why I'm so good about reminding people that DreamWorks and DreamWorks Animation are different companies, but I'm not good when it comes to Time Warner and Time Warner Cable.
Well, we will be from now on. What else will we be? If anybody else has any other corrections, where should they write to?
Well, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We'd love to hear from you when we play voicemails on each episode from time to time. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher. I almost said Zitcher. I don't know why.
We should buy that, whatever that is.
Yes, because that domain is going right now. Of course, wherever podcasts are given away, that's where you can find us. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us. There's even ways to follow us. We have a Twitter account, @showbizsandbox is our handle. We also have a Facebook page where you can like us and follow us. The username is showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or their website, whoismgmt.com.
Check out their tours coming near you soon.
That's true, yes. We had a link in last week's show notes about that. Now, Michael, you have a website. I believe it's abamuspopum.com.
No, it's not. It's freetibet.org.
Okay.
And yes, we've just had Showbiz Sandbox blocked by China. Umgoy.
Well, if you can find some of Michael's writing and entertainment coverage there, you can do so maybe at michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing is on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.